Okay, so this is the second lecture of this seminar, trying to understand various pieces of work, recent work around Ricci flow, three manifolds, and possible applications to and from physics. So the first comment that I want to make has to do with something that appears in Perlman's original paper. So what I wrote out for you last time was a functional, which he describes, which involves not only the Riemannian metric, but and its curvature, but also an auxiliary function, which physicists recognize as playing the role of a dilaton in a physical theory that involves both a metric, which they would often call a graviton, and a scalar field, which would be called a dilaton. The comment is that a little later in the paper, Perlman introduces a sort of modification of this functional, which involves not only the metric and this function, but a scale parameter tau. So tau is supposed to be thought of as a scale parameter. And when you put in the scale parameter, you end up studying the following functional. So you scale these terms. And I've just realized that I have no clue what n means.
The dimension.
N is the dimension of the manifold? Thank you. So this looks like a rather trivial change, and the restriction. So before there was a restriction which essentially meant that the measure defined by e to the minus f dv was to be held constant. And in this case, the restriction is that the integral over m of 4 pi tau to the minus n over 2 e to the minus f dv is supposed to be 1. So this is allowing for some scaling of the total volume.
Dave, how did the parentheses go?
There's 1 to 2. Many.
Indeed. Or 1 too few. So the evolution equations here, which generalize the evolution equation which we wrote down that involved both the Ricci flow for the metric as well as some kind of flow on that function f, the evolution equations look like the partial derivative of Gij with respect to t is, as before, minus 2 times the Ricci tensor. That part is staying constant. The partial derivative of f with respect to t, this time, is minus the Laplacian of f plus the norm grad f squared minus the curvature plus n over 2 tau. So this is where the scale factor comes in. And then the partial derivative of tau with respect to t is supposed to be minus 1. So these are just the gradient. That's right. You want gradient flow for this function. So these all come from gradient flow for this function. So Perlman is using this functional to establish the non-existence of certain kinds of solutions to the Ricci flow equations. So let me point out that the geometric solutions, the eight geometries, have the property that the metric as a function of t behaves in some predictable way. So typically, so in three of the geometries, Gij of t is just some kind of scale factor. Let me just call it lambda of t times Gij of 0. And whether this metric is staying constant, growing, or shrinking depends on the sign of the curvature. So the three geometries that I had in mind were the spherical, the flat, and the hyperbolic, and with appropriate normalizations, you could take that actually to be constant. What you're looking for is cases where the metric is only changing up to some kind of scale factor. And in the other five geometries, that's not quite true, but you can kind of split the geometry into a couple of pieces. So there's some directions where it's growing and some directions where it's shrinking. And at least locally, you can keep track of which parts of the geometry are doing which things. Maybe some directions where it's staying the same size because it looks flat in those directions. So those are kind of nice uniform behaviors. And in fact, these solutions are often called Ricci solitons. If you take volume normalized, if you take the volume normalized modification of the Ricci flow equation, then those would actually just be solitonic solutions, stationary with respect to t. And the name gets generalized to include this case where we haven't renormalized the flow, but we're going to allow some scale factor to come in. I guess the definition of soliton is that that would be true up to diffeomorphism. And so I mentioned last time that putting in this exponential of a function can change the metric up, the Riemannian metric up to diffeomorphism somehow. So you could imagine that there's some other scale factor having to do with the dilaton there, which handles the up to diffeomorphism part. But that would still be a Ricci soliton. Now, if you think about other situations with evolution equations, so this is a kind of stationary kind of solution, right? But you could imagine other solutions which are periodic in some way. So maybe there would be some time interval such that any time you took the solution at t plus delta t, you got, well, again, let me assume that there might be some scale factor needed, and there also might be some diffeomorphism needed. But you could imagine some situation like this where the metric was allowed to do various things in between, but it always came back to where it had been, or possibly where it had been up to some scale factor.
David?
Yeah? That's what he's proving, and in order to prove that there isn't a periodic behavior like that, including diffeomorphism, he needed to introduce this souped-up functional, including some scale factor as well as the dilaton. So, in fact, once you've done that, it's not so, and identified the situation with the gradient of that functional, it's not terribly difficult to prove that this kind of periodic solution doesn't happen. Right? So you have to find that some quantity which is definitely decreasing along any solution, and that prevents you from having this kind of periodic behavior. Well, there's some intriguing remarks, and I went back and read them again, Matt, after we talked about them, and I don't understand them still, so maybe you understand them better than I do. I don't know. Would you like to say a few words about them? There's some intriguing remarks which make an analogy, yes, I am, between this W and minus the entropy of the corresponding physical system. So I think that topic is going to deserve an entire lecture of its own, and that might be given by me and it might be given by somebody else, but I think I'm not going to try to summarize it quickly today, but I'm willing to let Matt try if he wants to. Okay. So I just wanted to remark, since I had gone to the trouble of writing down this one improvement of the original Ricci flow that Perlman had written down, I wanted to also mention the other improvement, which involves the scale factor and which produces something that's very formally analogous to the entropy of a physical system.
Is that the same as a topological entropy? Is that the entropy? This thing about how, How do you use except random space?
No, I don't think so. So, no, I mean, this is supposed to look like, you know, if you carefully make the analogy between the continuous conformal field theory with targeted Riemannian space and the statistical analysis of a conformal field theory, then there's some quantity that you would call the entropy, and this is supposed to be that quantity in this geometric setting. That's essentially what he's talking about. Okay, so that was sort of a little comment to add to one part of last time's lecture.
So, David, this first modification is supposed to generate a gradient flow that fits some volume.
That's right, and you'll notice that this time there was a scaling going on in the volume as well. So the tau was put in there to kind of change the scale factor of the volume instead of having that be fixed. And I think that's what makes this quantity actually definitely decrease on all solutions. So
does the term restriction mean that I take arbitrary variations of the W functional and that leads to this?
No, subject to this constraint, right? Yeah. So the second thing I wanted to say has to do with a conversation that I had with Gary Horowitz and Don Maroff after last week's talk. And they, quote unquote, reminded me, because I'm not sure I was aware of it before, that in cosmology, one could also study three manifolds, right? After all, we live in one. Well, we live in a four-dimensional space-time, so one could ask whether it could be true that we live in a spatially homogeneous cosmology. So might there be a group of automorphisms which acts transitively on space-like hypersurfaces?
So you're dropping isotropy.
I'm sorry.
Yes, he's considering homogeneous but not isotropic.
Homogeneous but not isotropic. That's correct.
I mean, this is a so-called Kausner solution, right? I mean, it's
I, as a matter of fact, scanned lots of different cosmology texts, and I saw lots of words like Kausner, yes. In an attempt to answer this question. The specific question which these guys asked me is that there's a classification. So actually, the classification fairly put is about the Lie algebras of the groups. And there's a classification which is attributed to Bianchi himself from the 1890s of nine types of groups which occur here, two of which have a continuous parameter. And this raises the very natural question, hey, I thought there were eight geometries. Why do you have nine things here? So so here's a partial answer to the question. Yeah, so the question was, why nine? And here's the partial answer. So in Thurston's program, one is considering, as I mentioned, model spaces of the form G mod H, where G was some isometry group. This is X. G is the isometry group of X. And for reasons that I don't completely understand, the standard maneuver in cosmology seems to be to find a subalgebra of the original G of dimension 3, which is acting infinitesimally
transitively. And although there seem to be comments scattered around, you know, this type actually has a larger algebra or group of symmetries with a stabilizer group, the classification seems to be based on these subalgebras rather than the full isotropy algebras. Now, there actually can be some difference, because what we then want to do is try to construct a four-dimensional Lorentz signature manifold which has this kind of action on the spatial slices, or on some class of spatial slices, and which has an action of the entire group on the four-dimensional space. So it could be that even though the spatial slices, these space-like hypersurfaces, have a bigger isometry group, it wouldn't be possible to extend that bigger isometry group to the total four-manifold. I'm not sure, but that's my speculation about why there's this restriction to these cases.
It can always be good initial data, right? Because you can always choose a constant curve, constant scale like symmetry. Is that true? Okay.
It's not a priori obvious to me that there had to be three-dimensional subalgebras which acted transitively in all of these cases.
Well, I just mean in terms of the question of whether it embeds consistently into the full time-dependent space.
Right, but then it could be that there's an additional symmetry at the space-like hypersurfaces which doesn't extend to the fourth direct, to the time-like direction, right?
Your argument seems to go the opposite way. You're describing it as if Bianchi is making an extra restriction over what Thurston assumes, but Bianchi ends up with 9 possibilities and Thurston is only 8.
Well, so Bianchi ends up with 7 + 2 infinite ones, in fact, right? So what I'm about to argue, although I didn't finish doing all the algebra, is that some of the Thurston cases have more than one transitive three-dimensional subalgebra. Well, in fact, a continuous parameter, I mean, continuous family of such things, conceivably. But the only ones I really identified on the nose from the stuff I found quickly in the literature was the one that's called Bianchi 1 corresponds to the flat case in Thurston's geometries. The one that's called Bianchi 5 corresponds to so the flat case is modeled by R3. One that's called Bianchi 5 corresponds to the hyperbolic case. So X is hyperbolic 3 space. And the one that's called Bianchi 9 corresponds to the sphere, X equals S3. So those are actually the most classical analogs of what we're familiar with in dimension 2. In any dimension, you have these constant curvature metrics, which are SN, RN, and HN. And in any dimension, they can be described as, well, here it would be a Euclidean group, which looks like the translation, so let me do the dimension n version, the translation semi-direct product with a rotation group. Here it's the rotations in dimension n plus 1, and here the natural group is SON, 1. Right? And in all cases, the stabilizer, or the isotropic group of a point, is SON. So in each of these three cases, in any dimension, you get a group whose dimension is nn plus 1 over 2, I believe. And then here we have nn minus 1 over 2, and the difference is n, which is what the dimension of the space, right? So these cases are kind of uniform in that sense. Then I sort of tentatively identified Bianchi 8 as being SL2R tilde, and maybe I had one other that I thought I knew what it was. So
See, mathematicians like to write out their Lie algebras with names, and physicists like to write out their Lie algebras with structure constants. And so matching the structure constants to the names was a little tricky. It's the wrong piece of paper. Yeah, that's the only one that I had any, only other one that I had any certainty about. Let's see, two or three. Yeah, I think that's. I'm going to say that's the only one I have certainty about. So I'll finish listing the model spaces again from the Thurston program because I have a lot more to say about them today, and then we can look and kind of think about how you would get a three-dimensional isotropic subalgebra. In each of those cases, and exactly how to match it up with the Bianchi table, I'm not completely sure. So do you know? I mean, if you have something like a type 5, you know, people are only using a subgroup of the SO3,1 to describe this Bianchi structure, right? They're sort of suppressing the isotropy. And do you know if there's a problem with extending the type 5? So that's FRW open or something, right? I mean, does the four manifold have the bigger symmetry group or not?
Yeah, I think there's a theorem which says that if you have a Killing field of your spatial metric and it Lie derives the extrinsic curvature, then the ball of space time has a symmetry.
Sure, but only if, as you say, Lie deriving the extrinsic curvature.
Sure.
So you could possibly choose initial data and the extrinsic curvature to reflect.
Yeah, so I mean, it's like the time derivative has to preserve the same symmetry.
So I see. So there could be cosmological models with these extended symmetries, but there could be more cosmological models that don't have the extended symmetries.
Yeah, the extrinsic curvature doesn't preserve it, then you don't get any symmetry.
Your statement is that any three-dimensional manifold which has the three-dimensional triangular symmetry corresponding to the Bianchi problem is actually a hyperbolic free space.
No.
No.
Maybe. So now we get back to this statement that you made last week, Daryl, where you said that 8 suffice. So does that mean exactly what we're talking about here, that there can be subgroups of the full isometry group such that if you took the left invariant metric for that subgroup, you would have gotten the same thing, right? So that you leave those out of the classification.
Yeah. I mean, so first you want to consider maximal symmetry groups.
Right.
To avoid...
Right. Right. Yeah, so I think that's the answer. The answer is that this is a complete classification of all the maximal symmetry groups that give geometric structures. And since that's true, the Bianchi list has to land in... Is there a geometry which has no compact quotients? I mean, is the list incomplete in that sense?
Yeah, I think there are.
Okay, so there may be some geometries that have no compact quotients.
Maximal symmetry group means what exactly? In what sense is it maximal?
Well, it's the maximal group that is preserving the metric. So it's really the isometry group of the model space, right? And so I guess what's being said here is that if you have this transitive... So how does this work in this case, right? SO3,1... So the group... Sorry, I had something more in my notes worked out about the hyperbolic case, but I've now forgotten what it was. But there's a smaller group there. SO3,1 is not simple. It's a reducible group, right? So you take one of the two simple factors, it's transitive. And so maybe it's SU2,1 or something like that. If you do it that way, then SU1,1. How about that? That's what it is. If you do it that way, then you know, since it's not on Thurston's list and it has compact quotients, this theorem that this is the classification says that this isometries will be bigger. Yeah.
I think in the case of type 5, at least something is pretty clear. I think you were asking about extension to a 3-1 signature manifold. But, you know, the way you should think of this is there's a hyperboloid in 3,1, which are is the sphere of radius I or something. And the 3 manifold is characterized by a discrete subgroup of SON1. So in particular, it acts discretely on the rays in that Euclidean space with mixed signature.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the usual picture for forming the hyperbolic 3 manifold is divide out the hyperboloid by the group. But instead, you can just divide out the rays by the group of isometries, and that gives an extension to signature 3-1.
So I guess one thing which the cosmologists would normally like to avoid is closed time-like curves. So is it ever possible that when you did this quotient, you ended up creating a loop in the time-like direction? No.
It would just be a product, topologically.
Okay. Oh, I see. The rays are, yeah, I understand. I understand. Yes?
In this context, the flow parameter is identified with time?
Well, I'm doing a simpler thing, which is to start with a geometric metric, which is, from the Ricci flow perspective we've been talking about before, the long time endpoint of Ricci flow. I'm starting with something which doesn't do too much under Ricci flow except expand or contract depending on the sign of the curvature, right? And yeah, I think now to make a simple cosmological solution out of that, all I do is put the right scale factor on the spatial, I mean the right time factor on the spatial part, right? I think that's right. And then I get a Ricci flat four-dimensional solution.
So to classify these manifolds, you also want to classify the discrete groups by which you model.
Absolutely. You have
and
to.
Is that a difficult part of it?
It's very hard, yes. Depends on what you mean by classify, but yes, I think it's hard.
But it's known. I mean, that was already known before all this.
But I don't know about before all this. So what's true, I think, historically, is that people did not think carefully about finite volume hyperbolic quotients until after Thurston pointed out how useful they were. But that, by now, is, you know, 30 years ago. So we've had 30 years of people thinking carefully about these finite volume hyperbolic quotients, and there are, I mean, if I understood correctly from what you told me last week, algorithms for listing them all, for example. I mean, so there's a countable set and there's an algorithm for listing them. Might not be a pleasant algorithm to use if you wanted to know what was the 1,000th one, but yes?
Would you be able to, from physics, generate some new questions about hyperbolic manifolds that we can think about?
Quite possibly.
Yeah, that would be nice if you have a question.
Right. Right. So far, we have to sort of get convinced that this whole program is going to be useful to do something of physical interest and sort of translate it into some physical situation. But then, typically, what's happened in the past when such things have been done is, yeah, there have been questions that flow back and forth very freely.
Because it's too
very
big to ask for the classification, but if you want to ask something, you know, like course classification, then you could get to work.
Right. I mean, so this kind of dream that I outlined at the end of last time was that maybe you could use this to build a theory of membranes. If you were going to do that, then you know you would have to somehow sum over contributions that came from all hyperbolic 3 manifolds. But and even thinking of ways to organize that sum at the moment is not so clear, right? I mean, it's not like the genus classification of surfaces where I've got this nice, and even punctured surfaces, I've got two numbers, the genus and the number of punctures. And I can do a double sum over those guys and understand how to classify the things. And, you know, tell me a few discrete invariants. The volume is one, I suppose, but that's probably two cores. How many hyperbolic 3 manifolds of fixed volume are there? Thank you. That's encouraging, but you don't. arbitrarily many, yeah, but how does it grow with volume? Does,
well, there's an unfortunate thing about the list, which is that it has cluster points. So there are these cusp manifolds, and they're the limit from below of volumes of compact free manifolds.
But probably for these applications, I'm likely to want to do something like fix the number of cusps.
But even if you fix that, there'll be cluster points in the volume function.
Really? Okay.
So that's. Do you expect that the low volume ones will be the most interesting? You know, that your sum will be concentrated on low volume?
I don't know how to weight the sum in any form at the moment. So I don't know where the.
Geometers and topologists have spent a long time trying to find the smallest hyperbolic free manifolds. They know a lot about that, the smallest volume.
But what does that mean? I mean, can't I scale the volume?
No, because curvature changes when you scale.
Oh, so you're so fixing.
You fix the curvature so that determines the size, right?
Sure.
Minus one determines everything.
There are finitely many closed ones at banded diameter.
Well, this is an interesting question, I think.
Sorry.
I think this is an interesting question because we're just in how the number of solutions. Changes with the volume of compactification, for example. And I'm also interested in this business of the relation between the curvature and the growth of groups, because that has a physical interpretation.
Actually, just one comment about this. It's actually a fluke in three dimensions that there are these cluster points. In four and higher, the hyperbolic manifolds form a discrete set of volumes. It's some low-dimensional phenomenon about cusps that allows this cluster.
So what I wanted to do today, so at the end of last time, we kind of ended up sort of reproducing this Thurston program as what Ricci flow would spit out for you. But I didn't very clearly state what the Thurston program is. So I want to just outline the Thurston program for you today, remind you what Ricci flow is going to do to produce it, and then with that as background, Daryl will tell us some aspects of some of the topology and geometry of free manifolds next week. So step one in classifying free manifolds is this so-called prime decomposition. And this is the part which, in the Ricci flow story, is very closely associated with the formation of singularities at finite time and what one does when one sees the singularities. I have to say that there are two classes of prime components which also lead to singularities in Ricci flow. So the singularity in Ricci flow includes the prime decomposition as well as a little bit of other stuff, but that's the basic story. So you start with a three manifold, and M, which is going to be a closed three manifold. So that means without boundary. And I mean, ultimately, I would like to also take cases where you have finite volume Riemannian three manifold with boundary. But I'm not enough of an expert to know which statements I can generalize willy-nilly and which ones I can't, so I'm going to not do the generalization today. But I'll remind you in a couple minutes why, for physics, we would also like to consider this somewhat more general case. And so this idea of the prime decomposition goes back to work of Knaser from 1929. Was there more than one Knaser? Because there was a guy in number theory who worked in the 50s. So either he had a very long productive career or there was more than one of them. And what Knaser did was he looked at two spheres sitting inside of M, which are so-called essential two spheres, which means that S2 is not the boundary of some three ball where the three ball is embedded in M. So what can you do if you have such a two-sphere? Well, the basic construction is to cut M along S2 and then glue in two 3-balls, B31 and B32. So here's my 3-manifold M. Here's the 2-sphere that I'm cutting along. And now what I have to imagine is, so what's the normal bundle of this 2-sphere look like? It looks like I could kind of thicken it out to a 2-sphere across an interval. So a topologically equivalent picture of this thing is to cut out that whole little normal bundle. And now we see that there was a sort of inside and outside 2-sphere. I can glue in a 3-ball on each of those sides. So that's essentially what's happening here. We're gluing the 3-ball on each of the sides. Now, I mean, my picture was a little misleading. A better picture might be kind of a cylinder, right? Something I can draw better on a blackboard, where it was the S1 that I cut out, and then when I cut it out, or I cut out a kind of finite extent of the S1, I filled in with a cap on both sides. So that's what I'm doing one dimension up. Whenever I see an S2, which didn't already have a bounding 3-ball. If I did this and there was a bounding 3-ball, then on the side where the bounding 3-ball was, all I got was a 3-sphere. So that's essential. That's why you put in this condition of the S2 being essential. Otherwise, all you're doing is sort of throwing off a 3-sphere, cutting off a 3-sphere. So I cut M along S2 and I glue in those guys, and it may or may not disconnect the space. So the new space M tilde may be disconnected or not. But if this is impossible, if there does not exist an essential S2, we call M prime. Now, how do you reverse the situation? Well, to reverse this process of cutting along an essential 2-sphere, I can take two different manifolds, or possibly the same manifold with two different parts to it. So I'll just take a manifold M tilde, and I'll identify two points on M tilde. M tilde might be disconnected, so I'm allowing for both possibilities. And then in each of them, I take some small ball, which is a neighborhood in M tilde, and I make sure that the two balls don't meet. So now I can cut out the two balls, leaving myself with a manifold with boundary. I'm running out of decorations. So M hat is M tilde minus the two balls. And that has a boundary, which is two copies of S2. So I can glue in S2 cross the interval, 0, 1. And in this way, I recover M. So what Knaeser proved is that every manifold can be decomposed into prime manifolds by cutting along essential 2-spheres. So that's essentially a finiteness condition about the number of essential 2-spheres. Every time I find one, I can do the cutting, and you've got to worry that that process stops after a finite number of times. That cutting can be reversed by doing this operation of what's called connected sum. I forgot to give it the name. And, I mean, connected sum is usually used to talk about joining two manifolds together. Here I didn't really say whether P and Q lived in different components. You could imagine doing a connected sum, kind of a self-connected sum on the manifold. If you do a self-connected sum, it turns out to be equivalent to a connected sum with S2 cross S1 or something like that. So, does the order matter?
The cutting.
So the theorem further says that you can decompose it, and at the end you'll have prime factors, and moreover, the prime factors will be uniquely determined topologically up to order. So the order of cutting doesn't matter. Eventually, you'll end up with the same set of components. And up to diffeomorphism at the end, there are a countably infinite set of prime 3 manifolds, prime closed 3 manifolds.
If you're going the other way from building up something from prime manifolds, there's no reason why, for a given M tilde, if you go over different P's and Q's, you have to get the same M, right? You could possibly glue together two prime manifolds in distinct, topologically distinct ways?
No.
What if I have a disconnected M tilde, and on the one hand I take P and Q on the same component, on the other hand take P and Q on different components?
No, that's certainly true. But what you can't do, if you have your primes sort of laid out in a row, mm-hmm. then...
There are two possibilities depending on orientation, actually, for the blur. So when you glue two things back together...
Yeah. I'm sorry. That's right. Yeah, I would like to assume that everything is orientable, and I should have said that.
So we just associate an orientation to everything?
Yeah.
So given that, what was the verdict about the distinct ways you could do this, the connected sum?
Well, if you have two connected guys and you take a point on one and a point on two on the other one and do the connected sum, then what you get is independent of the choice of the locations of the points.
Okay.
Right? I mean, it is true, as you point out, that if you took two points on one of them and did the connected sum of those those two neighborhoods, that would be a different operation.
So S3 itself is not...
It has no essential two-sphere.
Okay.
So it's prime.
So it is considered prime?
I
thought it was in a special category. So
maybe it's like one. It's like one.
It's like one, okay.
Yeah.
But my question actually is about S2 times S1, which seems not prime, but when you start to do this, you end up with just ones. So is it considered sort of also one, or?
Let's see. So S2 cross S1, if you cut, then so tilde in my notation is S3, right?
Yeah.
And so we consider that as having removed an S2 cross S1 component from S2 cross S1. So the opposite of connected sum,
it's not prime.
Pardon?
It's not prime because there's an S2. This isn't really fair. I mean, David's an algebraic geometer.
I'm happy to let other. I mean, the whole seminar is supposed to be a discussion.
Yeah,
so thank you, Michael, for answering my question.
Small exception.
Okay.
Right.
I mean, the point is there are two words that topologists use. One is prime and the other is irreducible, and they mean exactly the same thing except for that manifold.
Okay.
It's reducible because of the two sphere, but it's still a prime. It's just one little exception. Don't worry.
And what happens if I take the connected sum of this guy with some other guy? Of S2 cross S1?
Well, it's a prime factor. I mean, the way the terminology is set up, you don't really allow this thing of taking connected sum with yourself. Connected sum, by definition, means you have two distinct components. I mean, morally, there is the connected sum with itself, and that's what builds that.
Right.
In terms of the way the terminology is set up, it's not spoken of that way. So you can go ahead and connect some S1 cross S2s in as much as you like. You have 10 of those prime factors included in the prime composition. That would be perfectly fine. But when you go in the other direction, when you cut into prime, you know, cut a manifold up into prime pieces, you should take care to only use two spheres that separate.
Okay.
If you used a two sphere that didn't separate, then you'd be kind of doing one.
I'd be getting rid of an S2 cross S1 without having done so correctly.
Without getting a factor
right.
left over.
Right. Okay, so that's the old story. That's the prime decomposition. And in a way, that really got people started on trying to think about arbitrary prime 3 manifolds and what their structure might be. And I'm not a good historian of 3 manifolds, so I don't know anything that happened before Thurston came along. But there was a lot of stuff, right? I just don't know what it was. So in step 2, we consider various tori sitting inside the 3 manifold, or Klein bottles sitting inside the 3 manifold. And we consider ones with the property that the fundamental group of the torus, or the fundamental group of the Klein bottle, injects into the fundamental group of the manifold. There's no reason that that has to be true for an arbitrary torus in the manifold. You could easily have a torus which happened to be there because one or the other of its defining circles actually bounds a disk within the manifold. That's what we're forbidding by this condition on injectivity. So Thurston's geometrization conjecture. Sorry, incompressible. So what does incompressible mean? That's what this means?
It's technical. There are two concepts, one pi, one injective, and one incompressible.
Okay.
And under favorable circumstances, they're the same.
Okay. Would you care to elaborate on what the circumstances might be?
If the surface is two-sided, if it has a tubular neighborhood is a product, then the concept is kind of sided.
So the Klein bottle is not...
If you're orientable, no, then it would be...
Right. But we need Klein bottles for Bill's conjecture, right?
Well, if you're in an orientable manifold, the neighborhood of the twist, it would have to be a twisted normal bundle over the Klein bottle.
Right.
And that would be a torus, so you can actually get away with cutting along that torus.
Okay.
So the upshot was for T2, they're the same.
It's two-sided. Yeah, in the orientable case, yeah.
Well, I'm going to state Thurston's geometrization conjecture as stated by John Morgan in a nice expository article. He's got Klein bottles in there, and maybe he doesn't have to. So M is orientable, an orientable three closed three manifold. Given such a guy, there exists a collection of tori and Klein bottles. Incompressible in this sense. Such that if you take M minus the union of these guys, and let's just use TI as the notation for either the torus or the Klein bottle, that this is a disjoint union of a finite number of components, M alpha, and each M alpha is geometric. In the sense that I described last time. So we have to say what all the geometries are, but in particular, M alpha is supposed to be M alpha is supposed to be X mod gamma for one of the 8 geometries X, and moreover, the boundary components, if the thing is not compact, boundary components are all supposed to be diffeomorphic to a 2 torus cross an interval, an open interval.
Are we making M prime now?
Or? M is prime, I'm sorry. Yeah, prime. Do I want to exclude S1 cross S2? I might. Well, no, that's geometric already. Never mind.
Is this last comment about boundary components T2 or Klein bottle, or is that just T2?
That's just T2. somehow what I just cut out was the T2 that is at infinity. And I guess what can happen is that the identification that you make there can be the can include the twist of the Klein bottle, right? So let me remind you what the possible geometries are in these eight structures. So if we start with a closed three-manifold, the pieces may have boundaries. And as you may recall in last week's discussion of the behavior of Ricci flow, what happens to these toroidal boundaries is that the torus gets smaller and smaller. In fact, it shrinks exponentially fast with the parameter that goes out toward the boundary. So the torus is getting smaller and smaller as you go out towards that that boundary. So even if you started with a closed three-manifold, you might end up with these long necks describing toroidal pieces as the geometric description of the components, which are to be glued together, or possibly, in the case of a Klein bottle end, just glued, sort of self-glued, to form the actual compact three-manifold. Yeah?
Maybe a concrete example would help show the need for Klein bottles in this statement.
Thank you. Please supply me with one.
So if you have a hyperbolic three-manifold with a torus cusp, you could make a closed manifold by dividing out the torus at infinity by an orientation reversing involution. The motion would be a Klein bottle, but the three-manifold that resulted from gluing up the boundary to itself by this orientation reversing involution would be oriented.
Right, right.
And the then you'd see a single Klein bottle in there, and you could just cut it.
Right. So I remind you how you build a Klein bottle out of a torus. You take an involution which goes halfway around the torus by translation, halfway around the circle, excuse me, by translation in this direction, but reverses orientation on the other cycle, right? So that has no fixed points, and the quotient is a Klein bottle. So we could kind of do that at the end. But if we do that at the end, of course, when you take a small neighborhood of the guy, the small neighborhood of the guy was two-sided because it has this kind of, it's an interval, right, around the torus. And the flip just exchanges the two sheets. So you still end up with an oriented total space, even though the Klein bottle itself was formed in the limiting surface. So you can glue together, as Michael just said, you can sort of do that gluing at infinity and end up with the necessity for cutting along a Klein bottle. Daryl's answer essentially said that if you took a neighborhood of the Klein bottle and took it out, that would be the same as taking the, as if it had been a torus removed, right? I think that's the connection between those two things. Okay, so there were eight geometries. There were 1, 2, and 3, which I just mentioned, which are the strict analogs of the familiar constant curvature geometries from dimension 2. And let me put a little column next to these guys, which indicates whether non-compact finite volume quotients are allowed or not. So only a few of the eight geometries are going to generate these long tubes that we're discussing in forming the non-compact quotients. So here, no. All the quotients are compact. It's a compact space. It's got to have compact quotients. And what sort of quotients do you get? Well, you get things like RP3. You get Lenz spaces. Lenz spaces, I remind you, come from representations of cyclic groups in C2, which act on the three-sphere, preserving the three-sphere, and you take the quotient by the corresponding fixed-point-free action. You can take things like S3 mod the binary icosahedral group, right? All of these exceptional subgroups, icosahedral, all these exceptional subgroups of SU2, which form the ADE classification when SU2 is identified as the double cover of SO3 or the symmetry groups of the platonic solids, they show up as describing interesting three manifolds when you mod out the corresponding three sphere by those groups. So there's a sort of controllable set of possible examples in that case, and none of these long arms. R3, can you get non-compact quotients? No. So what do you get from quotients of R3? Well, it's all tori mod some other group. So you can ask which finite groups can act in a way on appropriate three torus so that there aren't any fixed points. And there's an algorithm for determining the set of such groups. The theorem that classifies them, the theorem that classifies them in arbitrary dimension goes back to Bieberbach. It's possible that the theorem for three manifolds is even older than that. Bieberbach was sort of turn of the 20th century guy. Again, those are very well under control, very well understood, enumerable in some very concrete fashion.
But infinite?
Pardon?
Ten.
Ah, they're 10. Thank you. Yes?
They have compact finite volume, right?
Finite volume. I'm talking only about finite volume quotients of X. So it turns out that any finite volume quotient of R3 by a subgroup of the Euclidean group is finitely covered by a torus. So that's probably Bieberbach's theorem, actually. Then you can enumerate, and my friend here tells me that there are 10. For a hyperbolic space, yes, we can have non-compact quotients. So this phenomenon of these tori that are getting small and these long arms is very common in the hyperbolic case. There is a nice theorem in the hyperbolic case which tells you that... let me back up before saying that there. So in the case of R3, as we're familiar with from the study of two tori, if we want metrics, constant curvature metrics on two tori, there's actually a finite dimensional parameter family of them. You need to specify an appropriate metric on one tangent space, but there's some choice in doing that. And similarly here, there's a finite parameter family. If I didn't have the gamma zero at all, there'd be a finite parameter family. And then each possible choice of gamma zero, non-trivial gamma zero, will cut down that family to some extent. So I don't know what the numbers are because I just now learned that there were 10 of them, but I do know that they will each have an associated subfamily of which metrics on tori are compatible with that group action. It's a question of whether you're taking a purely square thing or maybe making it hexagonal in some direction to allow some order 3 guy to go in that direction or things of that sort. That's the kind of maneuver that you would need in order to make sure that you had these other group actions on the tori. In the case of H3, there's this very beautiful theorem called the Mostow rigidity theorem, which tells us that there are no continuous parameters. So maybe I should have another column, continuous parameters. Here the answer was no. Here the answer was yes, and here the answer is no. So to do the classification, one needs to know something about all possible finite volume quotients of H3. That's kind of hard to enumerate, as the earlier discussion indicated. But at any rate, for each possible sort of combinatorial option, there's nothing further to do. The metric, the manifold, is uniquely determined by essentially the representation of its fundamental group inside the isometry group SO3,1 for hyperbolic 3 space.
So this is different from the hyperbolic 2 space?
Hyperbolic 2 space was very different where there was lots of moduli for a given genus. Hyperbolic 3 space and beyond, by the way, hyperbolic n space for n bigger than 2, there's this rigidity result which tells you that the representation of the fundamental group doesn't have any continuous parameters.
So there have been some physics papers that try and use this statement to say that it's easier to stabilize such a space. But it's not clear to me that these the lack of moduli couldn't mean that you have tachyonic fields, if you know what I mean. It's, you're saying you don't have exactly flat directions, but in what sense is it rigid physically? Is what I'm trying to ask.
There's only one constant curvature metric, and from the Ricci flow perspective, any other metric, well, aside from this possibility of throwing off three spheres which extinguish, which is still a little unfortunate, any other metric ought to Ricci flow to that one in the limit. So that looks pretty stable. I mean, there's just one fixed point in this flow. Now, what's interesting is if somehow the volume, as seems likely, the volume plays an important role in classifying all the manifolds here. The fact that there are these accumulation points in the volume may lead to some really interesting physical effects, right? That somehow you're trying to add up a bunch of stuff which ought to have been discrete, but actually the set of volumes that you're required to sum over includes some accumulation point, which isn't actually represented by a manifold, or is?
A cusp manifold. An extra cusp.
A manifold with an extra cusp. Okay.
And that's a kind of singularity.
That would be. Yeah. Who knows? I'm not sure. Yeah. The cusp means one of these tori. So an extra arm on the manifold at the limit point. Let me keep going. So then we had products, right? So we have S2 cross R and hyperbolic 2 space cross R. I don't list R2 cross R separately because it's the same geometric structure as I already had up here with R3. The S2 cross R cases have to be, so there are no non-compact quotients, and the only manifolds that I get are S2 cross S1, or a modding out of that by a Z2, which turns out to be the connect sum of two copies of RP3. So there's only one possible quotient in this case. To make it compact, obviously I have to turn the R into an S1, but there's only one possible other quotient. In this case, there are non-compact quotients. So in this case, the general picture is a three-manifold M, which maps to a surface sigma that has an orbifold structure and maybe non-compact, but has finite volume. And I'm slightly cheating by using vibration notation. Near the orbifold points, it has this ciphered fiber structure, which I mentioned before, which I mentioned last week, where you have the S1 action has on the fibers has one fiber at the orbifold point where it's wrapping around a bunch of times instead of going all the way around, but then all the nearby fibers is wrapping, you know, sort of going around the long way. So topologists don't like to call that a vibration. They call it a ciphered vibration in this case because it's not quite every fiber. It's not locally trivial topologically. But anyway, this is the general picture of one of these guys. And the non-compact points, well, metrically, if you put the right kind of metric on sigma, those points will sort of be cusps on sigma, so they'll be kind of far out, and locally, neighborhood of such a point on sigma will look like S1 cross an interval, and what we're doing here is putting another S1 on top of that, and so we get T2 cross an interval. This is a semi-open interval. So the boundary behavior of sigma kind of reflects very well the boundary behavior of the three-manifold M. Okay, I've encroached on my table, sorry. Let me put S1 cross 0 infinity over here.
So the finite volume restriction is part of the rules of the game. I mean, are there not finite volume quotients?
Well, I started with a closed three-manifold, so it definitely is a finite volume If it had a geometric structure, it would have finite volume. Or any kind of metric, it would have finite volume. Now I've cut it into pieces. So each of those pieces has finite volume sorted by definition. And now what I'm telling you is that each of those pieces actually has a preferred metric on it with finite volume, which is a finite volume quotient.
Okay, but I understand that, but I'm asking whether these manifolds have other quotients which look this. I mean, obviously they have infinite volume quotients, but which sort of look the same. But have
well, let me give you an example. I mean, an example with this sigma. So I've kind of left out the R2 case for sigma, right? But there's a compact quotient, the torus, but there's another natural quotient, which is the cylinder, which isn't finite volume. I mean, the cylinder looks like it should be sort of okay because you just took a sphere and punctured it at two points. And so you might consider such things reasonably well-behaved, and we might need to consider in physical applications some cases like that as well. I'm not sure. And then the last was, sorry, so this one has model space PSL2, well, I guess SL2R tilde, the way I said it last time, the universal cover of this group SL2R, which I believe is Bianchi 8. This also has non-compact quotients. And the structure of the non-compact quotients in these cases is very similar. In fact, these cases also lead to a non-uniqueness in geometric structure. The non-uniqueness essentially comes from the possibility of cutting sigma along circles which divide it into pieces, and then giving each of those pieces separately a geometric structure. So the topological manifold could have more than one geometric structure, although I believe the geometric structure will affect the size of that circle. So the circle would kind of pinch off if you gave it a different geometric structure. I'm not completely sure about what happens to those circles. And in the non-compact quotient case, it's a little hard to tell whether you have H2 cross R or SL2R tilde. It's a question of whether the topology of the circle bundle over sigma is trivial or not, and if the sigma is non-compact, it may be hard to tell whether that topology is trivial or not. And then 7 and 8 were these other three-dimensional groups, the nilpotent and the solvable groups, and they do not have non-compact quotients. So the only possible places they could occur are in compact quotients.
But they themselves are compact, right?
No, they're non-compact.
Oh.
But their only finite volume quotients are compact, is what I'm telling you. So the place where you get arms comes from either the hyperbolic manifolds or these two species of circle bundles, ciphered circle bundles over orbifold surfaces with boundaries. Right? And there are sort of two kinds of those depending on how twisted the circle bundle is, essentially. So, again, for if I can kind of put in this picture again of the blobs and the interaction, thinking of some of these guys as being kind of internal between blobs, and some of them as representing external inputs or outputs to some physical process, you could imagine trying to form a picture like this, where you would have specified some external legs in advance, so you'd be working in a non-compact case, and then you want to sum over all possible internal guys. Presumably, you want to do it volume by volume and keep track of contributions to different volume, and then presumably you've got to also take into account other discrete combinatorial data, which I have no idea how to get my hands on at the moment. In principle, we can now, so presumably you've got some completely isolated parts of the three manifold which were spit off during Ricci flow, right? Which could be these various S3, R3, S2 cross R, nil or solve parts which have no legs whatsoever. Or they could even be compact hyperbolic three manifolds which also have no legs whatsoever. Just among the possible manifolds with those boundaries having evolved under Ricci flow, you have to allow for the possibility of sort of arbitrary other guys in there. But each one is going to contribute something to the volume, presumably. And so if you're doing, if you're using the volume to somehow organize your thoughts, then for a fixed total volume, the number of contributions would be finite. And then you've got to assemble the pieces that are allowed to have legs and glue them together along these infinitely long tubes. What the picture is suppressing is the fact that they really are infinitely long.
So, David?
Yes?
You're talking now as if you're imagining Ricci flow with fixed volume. You're keeping the volume fixed when you're doing this. So my question was going to be that, you know, these S3s, which
yeah, I know.
Could be spitting off, don't spit off anymore.
If it's fixed volume, I agree.
Well, that depends if you're fixing the total volume or the volume of each component or what.
Yeah. Right. I'm not sure what I'm doing.
So some of these classes are finite and some are infinite. Is that right? I mean, is it?
Let's see. So here, so now we start to get moduli again, right? Here there are no moduli. In these cases, there are lots of moduli because in these cases, I basically have the genus of the surface, the number of boundary components, and if you like, the orbifold data specifying what possible kind of quotients I've formed in that case. And in these cases, I don't remember if there are continuous moduli. Are there continuous moduli?
For souls, there can be. For S2 cross R, there is, because you can scale the R direction.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
For nil, I can turn on.
So the only case that has both legs and continuous moduli, the only cases that have both legs and continuous moduli are already a familiar case to us. I mean, it's the moduli are really captured. There's one other parameter which, as Gerald's reminding me, is probably the size of the S1 or something like that. But, well, at least in this case.
Well, what I'm trying to get at is in dimension 2, there's the sense in which the hyperbolic cases are by far the most numerous, right? Is there a similar sort of statement here? Some sort of relative counting?
Well, what I would like to say is that if I ignore continuous parameters, the hyperbolic cases are more numerous because here everything was indexed by this simple thing, the genus, and maybe a couple of other things like the number of punctures and the types of orbifold points, whereas this really seems to be a much bigger zoo of possibilities. On the other hand, these had continuous parameters, so maybe that wasn't a fair thing to say about the enumeration.
Is it countable, the number of?
The number of topological types is countable. So if I suppress these continuous parameters, then it's countable. That was actually proven by Knaser, that the number of I guess it's not a direct consequence of Knaser because of the non-compact quotients, but it is countable in this case. Well, I'm kind of winding down for today. I think I also have a plane to catch. So I think we'll call it a wrap. More questions? And as I said, I'm going to have some office hours kind of aimed at students in a way. And because I've had physics students asking me questions till now, I'm having them in my physics office, but that doesn't prevent math people from coming over and finding it. All right.